Mahmoud Shama, number 092767. And we'll hear first from Mr. Pennelly. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Anthony Pennelly on behalf of Mahmoud Shama. Your Honor, we are here this morning to appeal with respect to Mr. Shama's conviction on count one of the indictment, conspiracy to violate the RICO statute, and also from the sentencing calculation made by the district court. This is a case involving an agreement between two Chicago patrol officers, which they struck, according to the testimony in the record, while working in their squad car. The outlines of the conspiracy, as it was proven by the government, are in the words of Mr. Droniak in his direct examination in the first volume of the record. They agreed, and to quote him without paraphrasing, that they would take money from drug dealers and from search warrants. They agreed that they would split the money evenly. They agreed that they would take money from an individual who was arrested when they knew that the person did not know how much money that person had at the time of the arrest. And that is, I believe, in essence, the subject of the agreement and the terms as they're described by Mr. Droniak, which support the conviction which we're here to appeal from this morning. Respectfully, Your Honor, in two arguments, we tried to point out to the court that, first of all, as to the requirement for a conviction of the RICO conspiracy under Section D, the government failed to prove any exercise of control or direction over the Chicago Police Department. Nothing, certainly, in the words spoken by the witness, Droniak, indicate that the conspirators spoke words in which they discussed how do we control or operate the Chicago Police Department.
Did this have to be someone at the top that they had were in cahoots with?
I'm sorry, Judge,
someone
I didn't.
Someone in whose job definition indicated they were in some control of the entire police department?
There is no evidence that any, it wouldn't have to be someone in control of the entire department. I believe somewhere in the upper management, for purposes of the test where there was discretion or control, a commander or a deputy chief, or if someone had directed them to or participated by sharing in these proceeds, then perhaps they could be actors under the definition of RICO conspirators. But there's no evidence here of anything other than them being at the very bottom of the pyramid. As of the 15 or 16,000 sworn patrol officers, they take direction and control from written general orders, procedures, and guidelines. They take direction and control every day from sergeants in a roll call that inspect them to see if they have on their bulletproof vests and if they have their weapons and their radios with them and their assignments. They take direction and control from lieutenants, from captains, from deputy chiefs, from watch commanders, and from the commissioner of the Department of Police. These patrol officers do not have the discretion, do not have the control over the department when they are performing the tasks that they do on the street.
But they're operating, would you agree, as police officers?
They're working as police officers, but I believe the test divides between person who does the work of the enterprise and someone who operates the enterprise.
But the enterprise,
what do we make of this language from the Reeves case? An enterprise is, quote, operated not just by upper management, but also by lower-rung participants in the enterprise who are under the direction of upper management.
That I believe that that quote says that in order to come under the definition of the RICO statute, they must be directed in that operation of the illegal conduct or of the conduct which is their conspiracy by upper management.
Under your theory, if there are two patrol officers who reach this agreement with each other, that can't be RICO under 1962C, but if they have a sergeant who agrees with them, then it would. Is that right?
Perhaps a sergeant, yes.
One of them has more seniority than the other?
I don't believe that affects in any way their job description or their duties.
One's a trainee, the other's a veteran.
I still don't believe that a veteran has control as a training officer over the actions for purposes of the test. And not just the test in the Revs case, but also in Brower versus Raffensperger and the other cases, the Warnicke case, the other cases discussed by this circuit interpreting that case, talking about direction and control. Certainly, I have not said or tried to say here or can't say here that a Chicago patrol officer cannot be found to be acting within the purposes of a RICO conspiracy in his job. That certainly could happen, but not in a circumstance where the only agreement was to do the duties that they performed every day before the conspiracy, in all of the hundreds and hundreds of arrests that they made from which no property was taken or anything was done. They made this little side agreement to take money. It's inexcusable. I said that to the jury. There's no doubt about it. I don't have a thing to say that it could be legitimate. But that little agreement just to take property, respectfully, did not require them to operate or manage or control the Chicago Police Department.
Now, you mentioned that they made this little deal in their patrol car.
That's what the testimony is.
And I'm sort of looking at it and said, well, I wonder if it would be framed around that, because they did have unilateral, at least for that point, other than being dispatched, I guess, control over their own actions. They managed to do a lot of things that police officers do legitimately, only they did it for an illegitimate purpose in certain instances. And I'm just trying, obviously the other side's got to explain this too, that in order to create this enterprise, their core function, you know, we use those words, talk about their authority, their power, they had that inherent in their job to exercise that authority and power when they're doing searches, when they're barging in on people, when they're using their guns and they're dressed in their armor and all kinds of things as police officers. They do this legitimately. In these instances, they did it illegitimately, and I'm just wondering if they have to create an enterprise out of this operation that they do every day.
Judge, if the government had indicted this on the basis that that was the enterprise, the agreement, the association, in fact, between the patrol officers to steal money while they were working, perhaps. But the government indicted this and proved to the jury that the Chicago Police Department, with its thousands of employees and its mission, was the enterprise here. They do not have the ability, and I understand they perform all those tests. In every RICO conspiracy, there's somebody at the bottom of the pyramid who's doing the work that actually makes the enterprise. There's accountants at the bottom of Enron. There are people who can't be charged in terms of their work that, you know, they somehow helped the conspiracy to take money, even though they did the tasks that allowed it to happen. Here, they made this agreement to take this money, and the second half of my argument is, of course, that they took that money when they were holding it for purposes of it being inventory, that they didn't rob it or didn't commit robbery to get it. But the agreement that they made, I don't mean to minimize it by saying it's a little agreement, but their agreement to take that property, they had temporary custody of those funds, they were supposed to inventory them. Their agreement to take them did not require them to direct or control the Chicago Police Office and its function in terms of all of the things that you described, in terms of stopping people for whom they had probable cause that were in stolen cars, were selling dope on the street, that they had reports were selling cocaine in hotel rooms. In terms of all of those things, they did not, those were not the thing. They led them to have the money, of course, but their agreement that when we ask a guy, how much you got? Well, I don't know. Well, then we'll take some of it. And their agreement initially was they'd take some because they'd pay for information with it also. But their agreement did not constitute a rise to the level that their job was controlling or operating or changing the function or making an illegal enterprise of the honest and basic function of the Chicago Police Department. That's the best way I can say my argument, I think.
And you're just saying they didn't properly charge it. Maybe they could have capsulized it that way, but didn't. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying they didn't do that. They did charge the Chicago Police Department, was proven as the enterprise. The jury was instructed that they may find, and they did find, apparently, that the enterprise was the Chicago Police Department, and that was the case. And that those were the facts that the case was tried upon in which the conviction rests in this matter.
Mr. Pinelli, maybe you're about to shift gears. I was about to ask you about your robbery versus theft distinction. I think I understand your argument with respect to, for example, money removed from the property room after it had already been taken into police custody. I'm concerned about how that argument applies to the money when Mr. Sciamma or his colleague in this conspiracy just take it out of the suspect's pocket and sticks it into his own vest. Why isn't that robbery?
Mr. Duroniak spoke to that in some detail, and Deputy Chief Dugan from the police department spoke to it in his testimony in the record also, when he said that an officer has the option when they recover. First of all, the Illinois forfeiture statute does come into effect here. Because when they find narcotics and money commingled on the individual, they have to take the money at that point in time. It's not a matter of whether if it's just marijuana, they might get out on an I-bond. They wouldn't have to inventory their money. But when they forfeit the money.
Would you agree that when the officer takes it from a suspect who's under arrest, it's that action is backed up by the threat of force if there's an effort to resist?
Judge, I believe every officer, I think the Supreme Court teaches me that every officer that makes an arrest can and will use some force to effect that arrest.
Presumably it's a crime in Illinois to resist law enforcement conducting an arrest?
Absolutely it is.
And resistance would authorize the use of force?
I would agree. It is a crime to resist in terms of that, and it would authorize higher force by the officer.
Why doesn't every arrest then carry with it and every seizure of property from somebody under arrest an implicit threat of imminent use of force if there's any effort to resist?
Well, there is the threat of force for purposes of making the arrest. Our point was, as Duroniak described it specifically, and I think it's at about 160 through 180 in the transcript, he talked about that process that you go back to the station, you take the money from the individual, either even when he takes it, puts sometimes in his vest pocket, sometimes leaves it on the person. According to Deputy Chief Dugan and Duroniak, he said, I was trained I could do either one. But when I get back to the lockup, I take the person in there, I count the money in terms of that. That's when he would have the phone calls, he said, with my client on the internal phone and say, you know what, the guy's got 700, we're going to take 200, we're going to inventory half, we're going to whatever we did. That's when they decided to take and convert the money to their personal use. If in fact, any time someone in custody has property taken from them, I don't know where you would draw the line. I don't know if it stops.
That they're in custody and as a result of all of this power and force to put them there. Yeah, maybe they're subdued at that point.
Well, they are subdued. They did cooperate. There's no testimony here that anybody resisted or that anything happened. There is some testimony.
But they did resist because of the potential use of force.
Of course.
And
then I
the
agree.
Same way when the same condition they're in when they're handcuffed or sitting or whatever when they take the money at the last stage.
I understand that, but the conspiracy as it's defined by the evidence here was we would take money and then after we found out whether or not the guy knew how much he really had on him, we would talk about it, and then maybe if he didn't know, we would keep some of the money in terms of that. So my point is that just the taking of the money on the scene, which he's supposed to seize, or if he handcuffs a person so they can't get in their pockets, at that point in time, that money is forfeited money. There's got to be a hearing, and they deprived people of the right to the hearing. They were convicted of that. We didn't contest that either. But just the mere fact that someone was arrested with money and money was seized, they had temporary custody. They're supposed to inventory all of it. They didn't. They took part of it. Doesn't mean that there's a robbery because they took that money for the purposes of the forfeiture.
Mr. Pennelly, you're pretty well into your rebuttal time, and I know you may have something else you want to address with us.
Well, I just wanted to briefly, if I could, then those two points with respect to that count one. As to the sentencing issues, respectfully, the enhancements that occurred in this case were contested by us in writing and at the hearing. The enhancement for the weapon, you know, and I certainly understand and we acknowledge in the brief the law that because someone is acquitted, Mr. Shema was acquitted of using a weapon in that one arrest with Matthew Smith, where he deployed his weapon. They arrested them for being in that stolen car, and Mr. Smith had marijuana. The jury found him not guilty of that. And I know perhaps that could be used still for purposes of sentencing because there's a different standard at preponderance. But the judge never made a finding as to how that came about. There's nothing in the record that indicates how. And I know what we said, again, to that jury was, we never said he didn't pull his gun. We never said he didn't use his weapon. He just had it with him. We said he took his gun out. He said, get out of that car. They got out, and the witnesses said, as soon as we got out and put our hands up, he put the gun away. It wasn't used for forceful purposes. It wasn't used for robbery. We all but admitted those facts. We admitted that he had the gun. So the preponderance didn't really resolve the justification that the jury found for him using that weapon. And that, along with whether there's any proof that he wore his vest, by the time you get done with those enhancements, they added somewhere between 11 and 13 points to the guideline range. And I know the judge reduced the range somewhat for sentencing, but respectfully, we believe the record is very unclear as to the basis for the various enhancements that were imposed. And so we're asking the court that that matter be remanded for purposes of an appropriate calculation.
Thank you, Mr. Pennelly.
Thank you for the time.
Greenwald. Government.
The evidence viewed in the light most favorable to the verdict in this case amply supports the defendant's conviction for RICO conspiracy. That evidence sufficiently established the defendant's participation in the conduct of the affairs of the RICO enterprise here, yes, the Chicago Police Department. Under Reeves, the Supreme Court explained, as this court has recognized, that a defendant does not have to have primary responsibility for the enterprise's affairs, does not have to have significant control over or within the enterprise, and does not have to be a supervisor either in job performance or in title, or it be a member of upper management. It can be a lower-rung participant. What is required, and this is using the precise language from the opinion, is that the defendant play some part in directing those affairs, that they be integral, and this court and others have then interpreted that language to mean that the defendant in job performance, in fact, be integral to the operation of the enterprise and the carrying out of the enterprise's activities.
This is just a tiny appendage from this big operation.
Yes.
And I'm trying to... And you're saying that appendage or whatever is enough to use the whole police department as the enterprise.
What we're saying is that the role of a police officer, just like the role of a plumbing inspector in Urban, which did reach the issue, and these are cases we cite in the brief, just like the of counsel attorney, not a managing partner or even a partner in the law firm in Napoli, those individuals if I can, Your Honor, answer your question by saying that what the Supreme Court and the circuit courts have done is look at the job performance of the defendants and see if that is integral to the operation of the enterprise. And yes, it can be some plumbing inspectors, some of counsel, if the work they're doing is carrying out the work of the enterprise. So what I think gets confusing, but isn't completely on point in some of these cases, is most of the cases, both in this circuit and the ones both of us have cited for you, are indeed cases that involve illegal enterprises or outsiders to an enterprise. The case law is there's less of it on what we have here, which is a legal enterprise and involving a vertical hierarchy. But the cases that are directly on point to that are Urban, are Napoli, and are Maloney, which this case says in dicta that a circuit court judge, one single circuit court judge in Cook County, not the the chief judge, not anyone that's overseeing a few courtrooms, but a single judge, is a co-manager, a co-operator of the entire circuit court of Cook County. So the prosecution we brought here isn't novel, although I certainly recognize there's not a ton of case law on it. But what these cases all say, and I think here we're particularly on point with Urban, where the Third Circuit said that these plumbing inspectors operated the Philadelphia City's Department of Construction Services Department, because in the course of doing their job, approving plumbing work, they were taking bribes. And what we have here are these police officers the purpose of the Chicago Police Department is, as we all know, to enforce the laws in the city of Chicago. And in this case, it was totally described both in the indictment and in the evidence at trial that's exactly what these police officers, what their duties were. These were police officers who were on the street every day operating, I would say, certainly participating in the operation of the Chicago Police Department. They were deciding who to arrest, who to search, where to get search warrants, who should be an informant, giving directions to that informant, and on and on and on. And in that way, just like the plumbing inspectors in Urban, just like the of counsel attorney in Napoli, who was litigating these fictitious cases and creating false witness testimony in these personal injuries lawsuits he was bringing for the law firm. He wasn't a managing partner. He was one of counsel attorney. He operated the business of the law firm. And in just that way, these police officers operated the police department.
Well, there's a lot of allegations sometimes of police corruption in a very narrow facet of it. Is that always going to be then a RICO conspiracy charge with just two people and the whole police department? Because I was frankly trying to look at this as a way to carve out a little nucleus here where they're doing something aberrant in line with what I have the power to do. And that's not apparently what you charge.
No, it isn't. And, you know, in this case, Your Honor, there's obviously other elements of RICO, including interstate commerce, other matters. So oftentimes in our cases, we do bring it as, you know, a case that involves an in-fact or an in-association enterprise. In this case, it was brought as the Chicago Police Department. It is the position, certainly, of the U.S. Attorney's Office that patrol officers do participate in the operation of the Chicago Police Department. That was our law in this circuit before Reeves, and we understand Reeves changed what the control element in terms of the law in the circuit and the description of that law, but we believe it still is the law in this circuit, or should be the law in this circuit and is the law under Reeves, that patrol officers do participate in the conduct of the operation of the police department. Will it always be charged that way? It will depend on the particular cases, obviously, but it was definitely charged that way in this case.
That would also carry over into the civil context as well.
Yes, Your Honor.
So that every time, for example, in a commercial bribery case or, let us say, an honest services kind of case, if that continues to survive, that winds up being chargeable as a civil RICO case, right? At least against those individuals.
Well, we totally understand that the law in the criminal context and the law in the civil context and the interpretation of RICO are the same, and that certainly should be an issue that I know Your Honors should and do consider in terms of the development of this law. The government's position would be we're not making new law here in the sense that we are simply taking Reeves and applying it to the facts here. And in Reeves, the court was pretty clear that you do not have to be a higher up. That you do not, that you have to be involved. In fact, in Reeves, it was responding to the dissent's concern that it may be too limiting the reach of RICO and in the sense of not allowing it to reach those enterprises that Congress intended it to or those defendants that Congress intended it to. And in the course of saying that, I believe the Supreme Court went on to say that you do not have to be, you know, in charge or have a supervisor or be a commander, as the defendant suggests. Moving on to the second issue that defense counsel raises, which is the racketeering acts. Again, viewed in the light most favorable to the verdict, the government's evidence was also sufficient to establish defendant's agreement to participate in the pattern of racketeering activity, here robbery.
Would you agree, Ms. Greenwald, that just taking money out of the evidence room is not a robbery?
Yes. Okay. Just taking evidence out of that fact purely, if their agreement had been nothing more than as an after effect, each time, you know, we make a separate decision back in the lockup to take some money from inventory, that would not be a robbery.
Okay. So can you focus... As I understand, obviously this was convicted as charged, and the conviction was as a conspiracy, but we've got evidence of a lot of individual arrests and seizures here. Which ones do you think reflect robberies? Can you tell us about that?
Basically, of each victim who testified, we believe reflected a robbery. Now, the four out of the five, four of them had the money taken from them at the scene, all of them but Benton. So...
Okay, I've got a list of about 9 or 10, so
there's more than, yes, there's definitely, I'm focusing particularly on the ones that had witnesses testify at trial, but there certainly were more, Your Honor, and the jury could have relied on those as well, absolutely.
Why don't you identify specifically, let's say, your best four or five?
My best five, and those were highlighted in the brief as well, but we could start with, Smith. which is the one at the gas station stop where they think it's a stolen car and that incident. And it's
the money on the spot.
On the spot. And that is both testified on direct as well as in rebuttal when it was highlighted for the jury that it was taken on the spot. Let me see. I'm hoping I remember all these names. The next one is the names are all just floating out of my head here. But
I can cue you in on
yes,
some.
Yes, you could.
How about Cleotis Love
yes,
on the forced
Love.
Entry into the home?
Absolutely. That's at his home, and when they break down the doors, and he's handcuffed on the spot at the location. The one in the hotel room?
Bates.
At the hotel room. Now, that one, Duroniak testifies he puts it in his pocket at the scene. Bates testifies he sees it on the television. But either way, both of their testimony is together on that he removed it from his pocket while he's in handcuffs after they enter through the force of weapon, you know, after they break, basically enter with guns drawn.
Lucas at the candy store?
Lucas on the candy store from him and his cousin, I believe. And that's the one where drugs are planted as well. And that's at the scene.
Okay.
And then the one that isn't taken at the scene is Benton. And our position on that is that in the context of a conspiracy, that also was a robbery, Your Honor, certainly an attempted one, because at the time he reaches in his pocket, Duroniak's testimony is, and it's corroborated by Benton, reaches in his pocket, pulls out the money, sees a substantial amount, over $400 or $600 or some amount like that, puts it back in because there's another officer there on the scene.
Okay.
That's why he puts it back. And
the case doesn't depend on that interpretation of that incident.
Does not at all.
What about Mr. Pinelli's point, however, that in all of these cases, the officers were required by law to seize whatever money or drugs they found, and
so that
whatever conversion occurred took place later?
I mean, I believe the testimony certainly was, that an officer can choose. Both Duroniak testified to this and the police department representative testified that an officer could choose whether to leave the money on the suspect or take it off him and put it in his pocket. I don't believe there was any testimony that they had to take it at the time. And in fact, with Benton, who was found, I believe there was a little bit of cannabis found in his car, he doesn't take it from him at the time because there's another officer on the scene. So the fact that the money is put in his pocket, when he puts it in his pocket, whereas many officers, and most officers, I would believe, put it in their pocket because they are carrying it, they are a custodial agent carrying to inventory it, when the defendant's partner, as part of their conspiracy, put it in his pocket, it wasn't to be that custodian to take it to put it in inventory. It was with the intent and pursuant to an agreement that they were going to keep some of that money and that they were going to decide based on the circumstances how much they'd keep, how much they'd inventory. And if not, then it doesn't make – in fact, Duroniak specifically testifies to that, Your Honor. He says, sometimes I took it at the scene, sometimes I took it back at the lockup. I took it at the scene unless somebody was watching. I mean, another officer was nearby. That's the testimony in this case, and we cite it to it specifically in our brief. And then finally, on sentencing, the government, again, it's all cited specifically on our brief in terms of the enhancements, but the district court judge on this, on the enhancement and the involvement of the weapon, you know, he heard from all of the lawyers on both sides completely on it. He read the PSR. He had presided over the case. And he specifically, while he may not have specifically identified, you know, addressed every single robbery, he addressed the issues raised and he ruled on them in the context of his sentencing hearing. And he also specifically addressed the whole idea of this some kind of form of double counting and, in fact, expressly reduced his sentence from the guideline range based on that. So I believe you'll find in the record and in your review of the record that the district court gave very careful attention to each aspect of the sentencing in this case. And for all these reasons, Your Honor, we'd ask you to affirm the conviction of the defendant and his sentence.
Thank you, Ms. Greenwald. Rebuttal, Mr. Pennelly. We don't have much time left, but take a couple of minutes.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'm going to go in reverse order. As to the second issue, the robbery, the government's entire proof of conspiracy, Droniak's testimony, transcript 122, question to Droniak by the U.S. attorney. Question, now if someone was in fact arrested, would you and the defendant talk about whether or not you were going to rob the offender of money before inventorying only some of the money or none of the money? Answer, yes. And when would you typically discuss this? Answer, either in the vehicle on the way back, if that was it, or if that was unable to do, talk on the phone. That's what he testified on the next page, 123, was the internal timeline. The record, and I give great respect to Ms. Greenberg because her description of the record is better than the record is here. The record is not clear as to which time Droniak did this. Droniak said, this is my procedure, this is how we did it. And so I respectfully disagree with the government's position that it's that clear that some of these are clearly robberies that took place when he seized temporary custody of that money. As to the first issue on the RICO, specifically we cited in the brief to the James Cape, C-A-P-E case, and the quote from this court in Gorin versus New Vision. Quote, mere participation in the activities of the enterprise is insufficient. Performing your police duties is participating in those activities. The second half of that sentence, the defendant must participate in the operation or management of the enterprise. Respectfully, Droniak and Shamad did not do that, and this was not an appropriate case for RICO. Thank you for the extra time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Pennelly. The case will be taken under advisement.